Hello, I'm your host, Erin Gruel, and welcome to the Freedom Writers Podcast. Today's show features my follow-up conversation with award-winning educator and best-selling author, Esther Wojcicki. The pandemic changed everything for educators and the students they serve. While in her living room last March 2020, we witnessed an existential crisis play out in real time. Our schools were shutting down, learning would go online, and the state of California was about to go on lockdown. Yet Esther was cool as a cucumber. She knew she could adapt. Today, we discuss that adaptation, the transition she made to online learning that her students at Palo Alto High School brilliantly embraced, how she adapted her teaching philosophy to the world of Zoom classrooms and Google Meets, and her exciting new project, Track.app, a new e-learning platform. While a lot of things have changed in the year since we first featured Esther, she's used her time in lockdown to create a unique technological approach to learning. In Esther's spirit, creativity, and ingenuity, I hope this episode will leave you feeling enlightened and empowered to make a difference. Using Esther as an inspiration, the Freedom Writers and I, too, adapted to face the pandemic. We learned to reinvent and reimagine what the Freedom Writers Foundation did on a daily basis. We created social-emotional lessons for life for educators to use with their struggling students during the pandemic. We also joined up with the Freedom Writer teachers to host what we call Zoom 203s in honor of My Room 203. And most recently, the Freedom Writers, along with student authors around the globe, are currently in the midst of writing a brand new book entitled Dear Freedom Writer. Several hundred miles away, today's guest, Esther Wojcicki, was also busy reinventing and reimagining herself. After leaving Palo Alto High School at the end of the 2020 school year, Esther decided that she needed to expand the reach of her educational philosophy. Partnering with RMMR, an early key member of the Uber team and a former student of Esther's, she co-founded Track.app, a new peer-to-peer edutainment platform. Track.app gives students the ability to become teachers themselves and share lessons with other students from around the world. It brings Esther's unique approach to teaching, affectionately known as the Woj Way, to countless students. So it felt only right to bring her on our show today to tell us more. Without further ado, here is my conversation with Esther Wojcicki. Esther, a year ago to the day, we flew up to Palo Alto. We were in your amazing living room and we were getting phone calls from your school and your students because the community of Palo Alto was one of the first communities courageously to address the coronavirus pandemic and to preemptively close down schools in a community. And I remember watching you masterfully pick up the phone and use your email to respond to this crisis in real time. And then, while we were in your living room, we found out that the rest of the world was going to follow suit. And we were scared we might not even make our flight home. There was exactly 13 people on the flight home. And the very next day, California seemed to shut down. So you're always on the verge of something happening. And at that time, watching you as this masterful English teacher and journalism teacher work remotely was awe-inspiring because I had not yet worked remotely in the educational sphere. So let's go back to March 12th of 2020. And you were already manning Zooms and Google Meets and phone calls. What was that like to be on the cutting edge?
Well, I felt prepared for the pandemic because I had already been using Zoom. I'd been using Zoom for 2 years and I was already having a lot of my programs, teaching, websites, everything was available to my students. And what happened last spring was the question was, what do we do now? How do we deal with this? And most teachers in schools everywhere around the country, they tried to figure out how to take the present program that they had and move it to Zoom. So all last spring, people were trying to lecture to students and then have them do the same kinds of homework exercises. And, you know, they muted them all because kids are not supposed to talk when you're lecturing. And whether it was on Google Meet or whether it was on Zoom, it was still the same methodology. First of all, I've always thought that that methodology didn't work, at least not very well. And so my methodology has always been to empower the kids and to put them in charge and give them an opportunity to work collaboratively and in groups and upon a project that matters to them. So what I did last spring, starting actually, I guess it was March or April, and it was a little bit early to do this, but I put my students in charge of the Zoom call. My editors were in charge. Let me tell you how that worked. No one ever missed the Zoom calls. Everybody wanted to be there. And so I had done that just after we did our interview. And I thought, well, those kids, they're in charge in class. Well, why not let them be in charge when they're out of class? Let's just take this same model and make it work. It was really incredible because those kids, they produced the newspaper as though they were still in class. It was unbelievable. They figured out how to collaborate, get all their computers to be linked together, publish all their stuff, and out came the newspaper in June as though nothing had happened.
You really could teach a masterclass in teaching because having been in your classroom and having been in those editorial meetings, it's so student-centered. It's so Socratic. And I love that everything is student-run. I love that you were able to tap into that same energy in a virtual space that scared a lot of people. So let's talk about taking away that fear, because those first few months of the pandemic, teachers who were out of their comfort zone were really scared about the digital divide, scared about engaging, and scared about using that new sphere. You had no fear. There was no fear at all for you. So talk about that.
Yeah, so I was fearless because I've always loved technology. So I remember back in 1987 when I got my first Macintosh computer. God, it feels like, you know, the last century. Oh, well, I guess it was the last century. But, you know, I always thought of it as fun and exciting. And I remember when I brought that computer into the classroom and other people looked at it and they had no clue what it was. You know, it was pretty interesting. And they were hesitant, let's put it that way. I did a lot of trainings for teachers. And I remember some of them, I personally thought they were hilarious because the first thing I had to teach teachers to do is how to scroll. Because they're like, my screen disappeared. My computer, it's bad. You know, it was just, I actually love those classes. But I think what happened when the pandemic struck, a lot of teachers were still teaching in the older model, the more traditional lecture-based model. And then they sort of had lip service with regard to the tech. And they didn't really know how to use, it's hard to believe, but they didn't know how to use Google Docs. And they didn't know how to use a lot of the Google Classroom products. So what we did, what we had to do, and it worked really well, is we just did training sessions for them. It's just they had to fess up and tell us they didn't know how to use it. And a lot of people were a little fearful of doing that.
Well, you know, I have to admit that I should have been your student because when the pandemic hit, as you know, I had traveled extensively. And it's one thing to be a sage on a stage. You're the guide on the side, which I've always loved. But my fabulous and talented staff wanted to bubble wrap me when it came to any kind of technology meeting. They thought, Miss G, don't touch anything because it will go away. And, you know, I wish I was in your masterclass. I wish I was, because when I went to college, I had a word processor. I didn't even have a computer yet, which is dating me. But I love that you've always been fearless and have figured out how to tinker and find the answers and build a bridge, bringing technology into a class when it wasn't chic, when it wasn't the norm, and there wasn't a crisis. You did it because it was the right thing to do.
That's right, because it was exciting and it was the right thing to do. And the kids were really interested. I mean, let's put it this way. They were so interested, they never wanted to go home. I don't know if you were there in my class when, you know, it was like, hey, you guys, it's time to go home after all, you know?
Oh, I've been there. There's snacks. There was pizza delivered. There was healthy food. And I remember you and I ate dinner in the room with them. It was so fun. And it was so contagious, their passion.
Some administrators used to say to me, well, you know, they're all after school for a while and they seem to be having a good time and they're running around here and there. What are they learning? They'd like, what are they learning? And, you know, I realized that that time after school and during class, when they were like running around, working in groups, you know, it was chaos. You could see like books everywhere, cookies they'd have or whatever. They were learning what everybody wants them to learn. It's called social emotional skills, how to get along with other people, how to resolve difficulties. Because, you know, the newspaper, every single time a newspaper comes out, there's always a crisis. I mean, most people behind the scenes know it, but the other people don't. Sometimes, you know, people will lose a font or their whole page will disappear. You're publishing 28 pages and, you know, what are you going to do with page, you know, 17? It can't just disappear. You know, you got to have it. And so what you're also teaching is crisis management skills, how to deal when things don't go exactly the way you want them to go. And it might just be a project in high school, but this transfers to the real world because nothing in the real world goes the way that we plan it to go. If you just look at the news today or just in the last week, you know, you see all kinds of news about like the vaccine didn't do this or people couldn't get it over here or what could we do about whatever. That's just life. People will say, are you teaching all these kids to be journalists? Do we really need all those journalists? And I was like, you know, I'm teaching them how to be functioning citizens of a democracy, how to be effective human beings, no matter what. But, you know, you just have to go with the flow in life in general. And I think that's one of the skills that you try to teach in school. At least I try to teach in school.
As someone who's had your name branded, there's the Waj way. We'll talk about Waj it a little later. But one of the things that you did so brilliantly in bringing journalism to the forefront was also living through an administration that demonized, vilified, and stereotyped the written word and those same journalists. So what was it like to be a dyed-in-the-wool journalist and know that our previous administration made them the enemy of the people?
What a great question. So I always said to my students, being a journalist is a heroic profession. You are trying to help people understand what has happened in their world that might impact their lives. And that is the number one goal of a journalist, to get the facts and put it out there clearly. They are saying negative things about a lot of journalists, bad-mouthing them. And the administration was saying that journalists, you know, are bad. And I said, just think about it. There's thousands of journalists out there, thousands. Do you think we all collaborate with each other and say, how can we spread this fake news? Which fake news do you think we should spread today? Do you think they do that? I mean, just look at schools of journalism. They're all teaching the ethics of journalism, and people do their best to be as objective as possible. And they label opinion when it's opinion. There are news outlets out there that unfortunately do not label opinion as opinion. I'm sorry to say that one of them is Fox News. And we used to analyze Fox News in class. That was one of the things we did. I was like, I played Fox News in class. And what you don't notice as a viewer, I had my students looking for it. They have a phrase. And the phrase is, some people say, and then they say whatever it is that some people say, and it's passed off as though it's a fact, but it's an opinion. And so my goal in having them watch Fox News was, I want to train you so that when you get information that might be questionable, do you have the skills to be able to analyze it and figure it out for yourself? That's what I'd like to do for all people. Everybody needs to have those skills. They could figure out whether it was fact or whether it was opinion, whether it was slanted, not slanted. Those were my goals. And that's what I taught in the class. And it was difficult for the kids to think that somehow the former administration thought that they were not good people. And I just had to reassure them, this is just a time in American history and it will pass. And I've been around long enough. I've seen lots of administrations and things passed. Mm. And it did.
I remember sitting in your living room. It was March 12th, and you had made the declaration that you were going to retire. And I knew intuitively that retirement for you was going to be a sham because you are the busiest person I've ever met. So when the pandemic hit, did you know that the reinvention was coming? Did you know that the Renaissance was coming, or did it happen out of happenstance?
Sort of happened out of happenstance. So what happened is I wouldn't have retired probably if there hadn't been a pandemic. But it seemed like the forces were aligning. And so I decided that I would retire. I had been in touch with multiple former students because I have a nonprofit called globalmoonshots.org. Through that nonprofit, I was trying to change the way teachers teach. And so along came June, and I announced my retirement. And some of the former students that I was with, we decided to start a company together. And the man that is the head of it today, he graduated in 2006. His name is Ari Memar. He was one of my amazing students. And we started Track.app. And then I thought, well, you know, we need some creators for Tract. How are we going to get them? And then right away I thought, well, let's see if any of my students want some internships. And immediately I had 20.
I need to interject. For those of you that don't know, Esther had been at Palo Alto High School since 1984. And she is the Pied Piper because once you are her student, you are forever her student. What I love about what they often call you lovingly, they call you the godmother of Silicon Valley. So when you think about Silicon Valley, because your high school was in the heart of Silicon Valley, you have essentially trained incredible folks who've gone on to Google, to Facebook, to Apple, to startups like Uber, like your co-founder of Tract.app. So what is it like knowing that you trained these beautiful students and they all came back to you?
I'm telling you, I feel blessed. I'm so excited. I love to see what they're doing every day. I'm thrilled to see that these companies are doing well and that they embody completely, most of them, taking care of the community, being forces of good. And that's what I always taught in my class. And that's what I always taught. Journalism is a force of good. You're there to help people know how to manage their lives based on the information they got on whatever it was you wrote.
When you think about being a force for good at a time when a pandemic was persisting and we needed that space of technology in order to eat for some of us, to communicate for others, and just to be together for those that felt isolated. Tell us about your vision, because you are first and foremost a classroom teacher. The walls went away, the bells went away, but what did you envision that Tract.app would become?
So it would become a place on the web where kids can create learning paths for kids who are just a little bit younger about topics that matter to them. And that is basically what happened. There's nobody more influential in a kid's life than another kid who's just a little bit older. And so that's what I was trying to create online. A little bit older kid who is creating interesting learning paths for younger kids. And we now built into the product the opportunity for kids to meet with each other. They have like little clubs now where kids that are interested in writing, for example, can be in that club, or arts and crafts or magic. There's a lot, and it gives them an opportunity to interact with their peers. And it's a safe space because in order to join, you have to be a kid. And it was my goal to empower kids everywhere. I couldn't wait around for the school system to do it anymore. I've been waiting for almost 40 years. In fact, I decided that I was going to just do it online. And so my students, before the pandemic, whenever they needed to find out something, I would tell them, well, I can tell you, or you can learn how to do it by yourself online. Why don't you try to do it first online? And then if you can't figure it out, I'll show you how to do it. And I explained it to them. It's like, you know, you can't take me to college with you, and you can't take your mom and dad to college with you either. So you have to learn to be as independent and self-sufficient as possible and be able to evaluate the results of a search. How do you know if this is good information or not? So that was the other thing that I always taught. I have a friend that published a great book called The Joy of Search, and I just highly recommend it. He was at, still is at Google. He's in charge of user happiness. And the reason they gave him that title is because the user is really happy when they can find what they want online. And so you can get his book. You can find anything. Honestly, you can walk down the street and you can see a plant there. And you're like, what kind of plant is that? You can find it. I'm not kidding. You can find out what kind of dog that is. There's so much stuff that you can find out. Most people just use their phones for texting and for listening to music. And for that TikTok thing, honestly, I don't want to say anything bad about TikTok, but each one of those videos seemed to be very similar to the previous video. And, you know, I was thinking, gee, maybe I should learn how to do that dance. And so,
but Esther, what you did that was brilliant. I was on your app today is you, if you can't beat them, join them. You incorporate TikTok challenges as a way of teaching. And I love that you realize what's out there. You realize what kids gravitate to. And you've created this safe space, as you've said, for almost a virtual mentor who may be a high school student and a mentee virtually who may be between the ages of 8 and 14. I mean, what an incredible model for these kids to come together using what they're already doing, embracing video games. I saw one of your workshops was how to get likes and how to use social media to your advantage. So you're really empowering kids to create classes around the stuff that interests them.
That's absolutely right. I want to empower kids. And so I want a place for kids to go online where parents will say, why don't you go on track now? Instead of, why don't you close your computer? I want parents to be able to relax, realize that their kids might be learning something really useful while also having a good time. And this month, we're tying a lot of what we're doing to the United Nations goals. And this month, we're celebrating Women's History Month. And one of our lead people that is helping is Megan Smith, who was the CTO under the Obama administration. She's an amazing woman, and she's doing all kinds of, she made a video for us. Next month is Climate Month. And I'm telling you, I'm so excited about Climate Month because the idea is what can you do at home to change the way the planet is going? So one of my, again, a former student is heads up this group called Planet Home. Planet Home, check it out. It has about 50,000 followers. And they give you ideas of what you as a kid can do at home to make a difference.
Well, you know what I loved? Because your podcast will come out in the month of Women's History Month, is that part of this challenge is you also are teaching philanthropy. And I love that under the umbrella of Women's History Month, that you're encouraging kids to learn about Malala and also that they can donate and get involved with her initiative. So I love that you are paying it forward and also allowing kids to learn about grace and generosity and philanthropy at 8 years old. That's an amazing gift that you are giving these kids.
I really think that if we all work together, if all kids grow up with this mindset, the world will be a better place. And we don't have a lot of choice because we just have one planet and we need to take care of that planet. And right now, we are not cooperating on taking care of the planet. That's why TRACT is international. We're hopefully going to be going into the Far East and also into Latin America, because we all need to work together. And kids are the change makers. Kids are going to make the changes we need to be able to save our planet. And, you know, while I admire Elon Musk for trying to get to Mars or the moon or both, I actually don't want to go. I kind of like it here. So I don't know who maybe wants to go, but not me.
You know, I love your sense of humor, and even you're a prolific writer, a best-selling author, and even just the way in which you embrace your audience with Track.app. I love the scenes that you create, because I find myself just giggling out loud. And the one that really made me giggle was the scene that you painted of that Ferris Bueller's moment, because I actually used that exact scene in my teacher trainings, that moment of looking out into a sea of students who are chewing gum and blowing bubbles and, you know, glaring at the teacher. And he says,
Bueller, Bueller, Bueller.
And no one is paying attention. And so you set that scene for your audience immediately on your website, that sometimes the teacher is not engaging them. And that's where these kids come in. They're going to take that engagement up to another level. So talk about using humor as you are presenting TRACT to the world.
Well, honestly, I think humor helps us get through a lot of difficult situations. And I can just tell you, you know, on a daily basis as a teacher, you know, things always happen every day. It's not just once in a while. But I can give you a really far out example. I used to take the kids to New York City for a week in the spring so we could go to Columbia Journalism Conference. And I was 52 kids. And the reason I picked 52 was because the bus only holds 52 kids.
And you know, there probably could have been 7 buses. That's how many kids you probably wanted to go. So I love that you had to cut it off just because the bus fit 52.
That's right. The first few days in New York, they kind of had to stick with me because, you know, they don't know New York yet and so forth. And I bought them this pass on the metro and the buses and everything. It was one of those 7-day things where you can just travel as much as you want. So we were at 42nd Street, sort of in the heart of Manhattan. And they don't really know the subway system that well. And so I got the whole group on the train, or we were on and spread out in 3 cars. And lo and behold, I look up and this, God bless, we're going the wrong way. We're going uptown, not downtown. Oh, geez. So I took all the kids who were in my car and I was like, get off at the next stop. And then why don't you wave to the kids in the other car? Tell them to get off too. So you can't believe it was just chaos. And, you know, some of the kids got off and then the other kids we got off and then the other kids went by and they were waving at me from the, I was like, oh my God. So, you know, let's put it this way. I could have cried, but instead I laughed because it was craziest thing ever. And, you know, it was memorable. The kids talked about it all the time. Anyway, it took an hour longer for us to get to where we were going, but they all eventually got there and they made jokes about it nonstop. So I think your sense of humor helps you get through a lot of things like that. And, you know, I was just thinking, you know, a typical administrator or teacher might not have been laughing.
I think you have a spirit of asking for forgiveness, not permission, which I think probably served you well. I took my students to Bosnia-Herzegovina and I lost a student. We did a trek to Mostar and one of my students who has ADHD got off the bus before we took off and went back to his room and took a little nap. And we found ourselves at a restaurant. And this is right after the genocide. So I felt like I was missing an appendage and I'm counting fingers and toes. And then I realize I'm missing a student. We called the hotel, thank God. And he was there and just, you know, ordering room service. And, you know, I know that feeling of, oh my gosh, we're going to laugh about this someday because it's going to keep us from crying in the moment. And I think that when I think of you as this Pied Piper in the streets of Manhattan, the trust these parents must have had of you. Because California, Palo Alto is very different than Manhattan. So I love that these parents said, take our babies, give them a sense of sophistication.
That's right. It was so great. The parents were incredibly supportive. The kids had a great time. We all had a great time. And that went on for 16 years. I took them to the New York Times. What was interesting also, New York Times has never had 52 kids visit. So I'm still famous at the New York Times. Remember that teacher that used to bring all those kids from California? So it was a great experience. And overall, there were a lot of things that were really humorous moments. And they could have been not so humorous if you didn't have the right mindset.
But I love that you've taken that into this online space. Because I think, lest we forget, when the pandemic first hit, there was, you know, a lot of nefarious things that people were trying to do in that educational space to rattle people. And a lot of teachers, you know, were scared. Were they going to have images drawn in the midst of a Zoom presentation? Or was there going to be an uploading of a naughty video? And, you know, there were those elements that rattled teachers who weren't prepared for it. But I love that the good always outweighs the bad. So I think you knew that. You knew that then, and you know that intuitively now in this new space, is the good's always going to outweigh the bad.
That's right. That's been my philosophy all along. The good will outweigh the bad. And if you can work together with kids and teach them that, then it actually happens. And because I've had a lot of students that also came from difficult circumstances. Some of them were, you know, the free and reduced lunch kids who came from areas where it was a struggle, East Palo Alto. Mm-hmm. And I can tell you that the most exciting thing that I did is help them reconceptualize their belief in themselves and what they could achieve in life. And I hear from a lot of them, and I'm just so happy when I hear the things that they're doing. Those are my gifts.
You give them tangible gifts as well. What I've always admired about you is, yes, you challenge your kids to critical think, and yes, you challenge them to question authority, but you've always been really sensitive in the community in which you teach that there are kids that are probably intimidated, and knowing that there is a digital divide along socioeconomic levels, you have always made it your mission to make sure that technology was for everyone. And I really respect that you were trying to give away computers before it was chic. You were always trying to help kids have access to technology before it was something that, you know, a mandate from above. You've always done that in your own gentle way. So the amount of computers you've given away over the years is pretty astounding.
So my theory all along, back in when it first started, actually in the 90s and or 2000s, where people were actually trying to block kids from using their electronic devices. And there's schools that they're called phone hotels, where you put your phone when you come into the school and you get it out at 3:30 in the afternoon. My theory has always been, you are passing up an opportunity to teach kids how to use that device in an intelligent way. Just getting rid of it does not solve the problem. So I've always wanted kids to be given an opportunity to do things independently and to believe in themselves. That's just part of my DNA, I guess. And if you read my book, you'll see it's related to my childhood.
Well, speaking of your DNA, I think that you've passed down some really good DNA. And I think that everything you did that was so successful in the classroom is what was so successful in your home. And no wonder your last book was a number one bestseller on Amazon. Because as a mom, you've instilled some pretty astounding traits of trust and independence in your daughters. Your three beautiful daughters have all reached the kind of success that we revel in International Women's Month. So, you know, I'm sure in history books, your daughter and yourself, all of your daughters, are going to have pictures. So for our audience members who aren't familiar with why your daughters are going to be in these history books beside their mother. Talk about that DNA that you've spread.
Well, I'm really happy that I spread this DNA. And I think somebody asked me last night on one of these Clubhouse events, whether it was nature or nurture. And of course, I think you all have the DNA, which is where you start. But I do think that it's nurture that does make the big difference. And, you know, so I'd like to tell parents out there that, you know, you can make a difference, and teachers that you can make a difference. And so my daughter, my oldest daughter, for those of you who might not know, is Susan, and she is the CEO of YouTube. And talk about a challenging job. That's a really challenging job. I'm very impressed with what she's done because she's spent a lot of time adding things for kids. So there's the kid version of YouTube that you can put your child on and not worry. My second daughter is Janet. She is a professor of pediatrics at UCSF Medical Center. And her focus is, again, kids, but how kids should eat and what parents should feed kids so that they'll have a long, healthy, happy life instead of, you know, so many kids are obese at an early age, and then they become obese adults, and then they have all these health issues, including diabetes and cancer and heart problems. And so how can we prevent that from happening? And so she works with a lot of different groups in San Francisco, and she puts out articles, and she's a great academic. My third daughter is Anne, and Anne is the CEO and co-founder of 23andMe, the personal genetics company. And I must say, that is really amazing because I just read this article yesterday. The people that she brings together, there were these two women who were working together and had been working together for a couple of years who took 23andMe test only to discover they were sisters. Unbelievable.
That's the stuff that movies are made of.
It is, right. It is, but every day there's something amazing that happens as a result of 23andMe data. So of course, I'm very proud of them. And I'm proud that they're doing things that are making the community a better place, making the world a better place.
When you think about the chicken and the egg, your book, How to Raise Successful People. What I love is that you have, and now you give a blueprint for people while they've got a kid in the womb and in utero. They can read your book and say, I have a blueprint that I don't need to be a helicopter parent. I don't have to be neurotic and hover over them. I can do all the things that Esther did. And my kids will be top researchers and entrepreneurs and tech geniuses just like you.
Well, right. But, you know, they don't necessarily have to go into those fields. But what you want them to do is to go into something that's going to make a difference to them, that they feel passionate about, and that will also make the world a better place, whatever it is. If you just think of all the jobs that people have in the world, they all make a difference for all of us. I mean, even the custodians, we celebrated our custodians in my building. I mean, without them, the place would be really dirty. You know, they all contribute to making life better for everyone. I should also mention that when all three of them graduated from college, not one of them had a job. So all those parents that are worried out there that their child doesn't have to know exactly what they want to do when they start college, they can relax. It's okay. They'll be fine.
You made me feel calm on March 12th last year in the midst of this chaos. You make me feel calm today. I feel like the sun is shining. Vaccines are going into arms and things are going to get better. And what you have done in this year is proactively and creatively try to do just that. Realizing that everyone was at home, everyone was on a gadget, and you thought, I want to make that gadget time meaningful and relevant. So if a parent is listening and they want their child to do something that's meaningful and that's creative and that is student-centered. Attract them to track.app. You could be the siren. You could be the muse for a parent who says, enough with a Fortnite, enough with all of these video games where there's destruction.
That's right. I don't like the video games that have a lot of violence in them. You know, I'm a chicken. I don't like to see bad things happen to anybody. And those video games, they scare me. And
me too.
And I think they scare the kids too, but they get used to them. And I think it's really bad to get used to killing and violence. I just don't think that's a good idea. So what I'm trying to do is to make sure that kids have that opportunity to do something beneficial and have a good time while they're doing it and not just do nonsense types of things. I think it's so important. And I also want to reassure parents, really, again, that if you just empower your child, they will want to do something that makes a difference. I was surprised on Tract that one of the things that they can get when it's a gamified learning platform, they can get prizes, they get like toys and food and all kinds of things, but they can also do things like plant a tree or donate a meal to another child. I was shocked at how many kids wanted to donate a meal to another child and plant a tree. We never asked them. They have a choice of a lot of things that they could do. So I think innately, kids are really good and they really want to help make the world a better place and help with all these climate issues we're having. Yes, I would like to encourage parents to relax.
I also think a thank you is in order. As you know, when the Freedom Writer's Diary was first conceived, it was in our hermetically sealed bubble in my classroom, room 203. And years later, I was able to bring in 150 teachers in the same vein of my 150 Freedom Writers. And we collaboratively wrote a book. But during the pandemic, we were all separated. There was no planes, trains, and automobiles. So our publishing house came back and we have started a new project. And because of you and your love affair with Google Docs, we are creating this new book through Google Docs in 100 different locations. So we have 50 authors globally and freedom writers and teachers making this commitment to write this book collaboratively through Google Docs. And I need to thank you because for a decade, you have been singing the praises of how easy it makes everything. You were right. So I'm going to shout it to the rooftops that you were right. But how did you know back then? I know it's your journalism edge, but how did you know that it just makes everything easier?
Well, I tried it. First of all, I was this English teacher and I was carrying home pounds and pounds of papers. And I knew that when I got that paper, if I corrected the first few paragraphs, I could see right then and there that there were problems. But if I would have been able to see that before the whole paper was written, then I could have told them about it. And then they wouldn't have to rewrite it and revise it so much. When Google Docs came out, you, the teacher, could see the student and what they were doing right away. And you could then put a little message in there where you could say, by the way, did you think of doing this? Or by the way, this is not the way that would work the best on your paper. How about trying this? You could course correct before the whole course was done. It is so incredible and it facilitates collaboration. I didn't have to carry home pounds and pounds of papers anymore. The kids collaborated with each other. It was so amazing. That's how this newspaper is done, by the way, and the magazines and everything else. It's all peer-to-peer edited. And if you read the writing in those publications, you'd say, oh my God, it doesn't look like a high school. It looks like the New York Times. And it's because the kids can recognize in other people's writing sometimes things that they make mistakes on themselves, and then it helps them improve their own writing. It works like a charm. I'm so happy you're doing this. I cannot tell you how happy I am.
Well, for those that don't know, she's my teacher and I am her student. You're always right. You're always ahead of the curve. You always have your ear to the grindstone.
And so you just hear things first and you strike first. So I look at you and I realize you're so optimistic, even though we're still in a pandemic. You are so optimistic about journalism is going to be back better than ever. Schools are going to come back better than ever. Technology is going to help our kids better than ever. So where does that stem from? All of that optimism that even when times are tough, that there's still going to be triumph.
That's a good question. It stems from really, I probably have to think about it. It stems from my childhood and the belief in myself that I could make the world better for me and for the people around me. But it also, in some sense, in many people, it also stems from belief in a religion. And I think what religion does is it helps you have faith in yourself and helps you have faith in the world around you, because you're praying and you feel like that is going to be a better path. You know, overall, I'm not really religious. I read a lot of religious books for my book before I wrote it, because I wanted to see what was the core of all the religions. So if you read the books, the Bible, the Quran, you will see that at the core of every single one is the same thing. It's really love and taking care of each other and faith that the world is going to be better and that you can play a role in making that world a better place. I don't know how that happened. I think I was just, it happened as a child because I had some difficult situations. And the alternative of being a pessimist and depressed is just what a terrible alternative that one is. So I pick the optimist.
I think one of my favorite lines from the Talmud is, "Whoso saves a life saves the world entire." And I think of you because you're like that rabbi. You save lives one kid at a time, one class at a time, one community at a time. And now your community is really global. That you, as that teacher, that rabbi of sorts, you are touching every corner of the globe. And you're going where kids are at. You're seeking them out in their homes. And I love that because you're ever the educator, but you realize if they're all stuck in a pandemic and they all have a gadget, let's get through this together. Let's make it better. And I that's so noble and it's so altruistic.
Yes. Thank you so much. It is altruistic. And I do think that one of the things that I recommended in some of the talks that I gave was that kids spend all day on Zoom calls where they're muted. Why don't you let them have a Zoom call with their friends? You know, why don't you let them do something important to them with their friends? So that's still my position, because the main thing kids have missed in this pandemic is their friends. And if they can get together with their friends, that's fantastic. But if they can't, then let them do it online. The Zoom calls just should not be only for lecture. We know lecture is ineffective. So let them do something where they collaborate. Maybe they can have two or three kids together on a call or a FaceTime call or something like that. Let them make a video together and post it on TikTok if they want, whatever. But we're all social humans, social beings. Relationships are the most important thing in a human being's life. And that's what was cut in this pandemic. And that's why we need to help all the kids reestablish those relationships.
So Esther, last year when we were together on March 12th and the world was changing before our very eyes, you pivoted, you reimagined, reinvented, and had that renaissance like I talked about. But a lot of teachers came to that slowly. And for many of the school districts around the country, if the COVID rates are still high, they are going to be online through the end of the year. In my community, schools will be online through June. So you're so great at giving advice. And for those of us like myself that take a while to take your advice seriously, we eventually come around. We all come around. But I'd love for you to give advice to first and foremost your brethren, those educators who have to suffer through this pandemic in their pajamas at home till June. What is your advice for them? And then I want to talk about your advice for kids.
So my number one advice for my brethren, my colleagues, is that, first of all, I think that you have all done as good a job as you possibly could have in face of a very difficult situation. And so if you look at the statistics, more than 50% of the parents say you did a good job and they appreciate it. And so to make your lives better, so you don't have to work so hard, one of the things that I advise is that you give kids more responsibility. Have them be more in charge of what you're trying to achieve. Trust them. Respect their ideas. Give them all this independence. Because what you're doing is then you don't have to work that hard. You get to sit back and say, okay, this might be great. Let me do a little course correction on this one, a little course correction on that one. But that is much easier than having to prepare every day for all those classes. It works so well. And for the kids and their parents, give your kids that opportunity to collaborate with their peers on something they care about. And if it isn't on track, it can be on YouTube, or it can be on just online, just peer-to-peer interaction of one kind or another. That is the most important thing that you can do. You want your child to say, this was a pandemic, it was really stressful, but I had the grit to do really well in spite of it. I did the best I could, and there are no negative side effects, none.
I'm so grateful for our guest, Esther Wojcicki, for providing us with her approach to online education and sharing with us her exciting new project, Track.app. In her honor, may each of us use optimism to make our world a better place. May we give children the opportunity to be independent, critical thinkers who believe in themselves. And like Esther, may we all encourage students to find worthwhile ways to use technology for good. That concludes our show this week. Thank you so much for listening. Once again, I'm your host, Erin Gruwell. This episode was produced and edited by Matt Martin Hall and Rob Falk. Until next time, dear listeners, may you write what needs to be written and tell what needs to be told.